didn't do anything wrong. If you didn't do anything wrong, just
talk.
You
have nothing to hide.
We've got nothing to hide. Just tell the story. Tell the truth. Answer the questions. We can rehab if we need to. Just Joe.
Let it rip.
Let it rip.
So why would two guys leave comfortable jobs, move across the country, and start a business in an industry they don't know, a place they don't know, and could it be successful?
We're Dale and Brian Carmi. Join us as we share our story and inspire you to become people of impact.
Welcome to the Impact Without Limits podcast.
Welcome back to the Impact Without Limits podcast. I'm Brian Carmi here with my brother Dale.
Hello.
And we are walking through a trial that we encountered as ForeverLawn in California. And the timeline, we're actually in 2010.
Encountered is a very soft.
It's going to get harder as we go.
It was like a dunk tank that we couldn't get out of for 10 years.
Like I encountered in the dunk tank. Yeah. Okay. Well, we had kind of walked through, and the first couple of days of trial were just crazy. And we wrapped up the last episode talking about one of their witnesses, Yvette, on the stand. And we went back and listened to that. We missed just a
humorous little tidbit that happened while Yvette was on the stand.
Well, yeah, we talked about Dan, their attorney's inability to ask questions and looking like he was cheating off Matt. And, you know, to see what questions to ask and trying to pass notes as like little kids.
And we had talked about his generally disheveled
appearance,
demeanor and appearance, dragging in files like these little dollies full of these boxes, full of files and a briefcase with like little pieces of dog ears of paper hanging out of them and stuff. So,
yeah. Well, one time Yvette is on the stand and when you are asking questions as an attorney, often you're showing some type of an exhibit, a file. Maybe it's an invoice or a email.
A printout of an email.
And you hand them that paper and you ask questions about that. Well, Dan was in the middle of asking questions and could not find the exhibit that he wanted.
Yeah, so he's up there talking, attempting to ask the questions. We've already talked about how that went. We're coming on. This was during the record setting day of objections.
Yes.
Matter of fact, this was probably the longest stretch where we didn't hear the word objection in the whole trial. As Dan says, oh, wait a minute, I have to find this exhibit. He actually turns around and walks back behind the table to his chair where his briefcase was. And he starts pulling folders out of the briefcase and flipping through them frantically, trying to find some exhibit, and he's not finding it there. So then he goes over and gets one of the boxes, one of the legal boxes, and opens it up and he starts going through it. Then the plaintiffs, Matt and Diana, they start rummaging through some boxes. This went on.
It was minutes.
For at least 3 minutes.
And again,
everything stops. All the juries, the judge, their team scrambling. Our team, a few people in the back of the courtroom, everybody's just sitting there looking.
Watching them search for documents. Awkward
moment.
And again, the comparison, if you haven't been in trial, you haven't prepared for trial, our attorneys had these binders. Every exhibit was numbered, marked, and they had to be numbered, right? The court had numbered them. So normally you have these in a binder and they're in some type of numerical order. Exhibit 2, exhibit 3, up to exhibit whatever. He could not find this thing anywhere. So he ends up taking this box up to a vet on the stand.
Guys, this was real life.
Sets it down and says, can you find this invoice? And everybody's just staring at him like, are you?
So he's asking the witness to look through his papers and find a document that he could ask her questions about.
She didn't find it.
No.
So that was the scene. Again, what we're trying to cover here is just the scene and what this was like. And
it a comedy of errors doesn't explain it.
Yeah.
It was surreal. It was encouraging to us, but it was also frustrating because we do get the sense. I mean, We're 3 days into the trial at this point. Maybe I don't remember.
Well, yeah, it was four, we called that day five, but there were a couple of days of like pretrial motions.
We probably have a collective number of objections over 500 at this point.
Easy.
And it's just absurd. Yeah. Right. And the judge is angry. We talked about it. Not us necessarily, but the group of us would get scolded every afternoon that
we're turning his courtroom into a circus.
We've lost the jury. They're bored and looking around. It's like, what are you supposed to do?
Yeah. So today it shifts. And today we have our good friend, Joe, taking the stand. This one, I'm going to foreshadow a little bit. They're going to get a couple marbles in their jar today, right? This one takes a little bit of a weird turn. And so what happens, we feel like we are really winning this case. They haven't been able to ask a question. They haven't been able to do anything. And so sometimes when you feel like you're winning big, if you think of a sports analogy, right?
Here we go.
Your sports analogy, you're up by 20. It's the fourth quarter. What do?
Kill the ball.
Yeah, you run out the clock.
That's not what I would do as a coach. No, that's what a lot of people do.
Play prevent defense, right?
Prevent offense. Either way.
Yes.
You have the lead. You're sitting on it. You're just trying to kill the clock. Or when you're on defense, you're just trying not to give up a whole bunch of points, and you're okay if you give up a little bit.
Yeah, exactly. And so we knew from just the way this had kind of gone and previous questions and depositions, we knew that their attempt was going to be painting Joe as the villain, right? He was going to be the guy that was out to destroy Matt's business.
He was the hitman.
Yeah, that's right.
Right.
When you were on the stand, they called him the hitman. So, and we were at dinner the night before, and we talked about this. We were at Ruth's Chris with the jacket that you had gotten for Joe. and we realized when he had that jacket on, he looked like a harmless fuzzball. He looked like just a cuddly grandpa.
He was a grandpa. He instantly turned into a grandpa.
Yes. You couldn't make him out to be a mean ogre with a plot to destroy. He looked more like a grandpa who lost his golf cart.
We're not saying Joe was a mean ogre.
No, but we knew that was their attempt.
But Joe is one of those guys that had a generally maybe grumpier demeanor than normal.
He might have had a goatee at the time.
And he could be angered, right? Was very frustrated with this whole California situation. He'd been trying to work through it for the last year and a half, 2 years. And it's frustrating when you have people, right? For a while, he was the primary person dealing with the other side, and to have stories changed and lies told and misinformation. He's angry, right? He didn't want to be there. And look, when you're angry, sometimes it comes across. So we were trying to transform Joe from the grumpy, angry old man. We'll drop ogre. We'll go with the man.
We didn't call him an ogre. We knew that's what they were trying to paint.
I know. But to this soft, cuddly teddy bear grandfather feature. And we realized at dinner, this funny jacket we bought for $1.50. That was pastel plaid and had the lining fallen out. It made it work.
Right.
So we show up at court that morning and Joe's in the jacket.
Yes, he is. So that's the first part of the strategy. The second part of the strategy was the attorneys who said, don't say anything. Joe, we are in a spot where everything is going our way.
Don't lose the game.
Just don't fumble, right? As long as you don't say anything bad. As long as you don't say anything,
you can't say anything bad.
Right. That's what they were saying. As long as you don't say anything, you can't say anything bad.
In principle, we get it.
Yes.
But that is a very difficult position to be in if you're on the stand, because obviously you're up there because people are trying to get information out of you and they're asking you questions. Well, Joe went into a shell, yes, right? Joe played prevent defense. Joe played ball control offense. They would ask him questions, and in his mind, he's hearing, don't say anything, don't say anything. So he's not saying anything. And what was the result?
It comes off as though he's being evasive.
He looks
like he's hiding something. Because he's trying not to say anything. He's not. And so there would be questions like, sir, you were in California on this day and you met with this dealer, this contact of, of JSA. Can you explain what the meeting was? And he'd say, it was nothing. There was no point to the meeting. Nope. Well, was it a business meeting?
Right. Why were you out there?
It was personal.
Just because.
We're friends. And he was just trying to do what the attorneys instructed. Don't answer the questions. But it led to this. They started getting some marbles in the jar, right? Dan, as bad as he was, Dan was decent at being deceptive and manipulative and parsing words and putting words in Joe's mouth and kind of painted him into some corners on a couple different occasions.
It was uncomfortable. It was uncomfortable for Joe. It was uncomfortable for us watching. And you could see for the first time in this trial, the jury starting to
just question,
turn a little bit like this seems off.
Yeah. And, you know, I would say it painted an inaccurate picture. And I don't know that Joe said words that were clearly inaccurate, but the way it painted the picture, it came off.
He was evasive, Brian. I mean, if you're sitting there judging, you're like, this guy's hiding something.
Yeah.
That's what it felt like.
Yeah.
It's like, there's something here. We don't know what it is. He didn't say anything that you knew what he was hiding, but you knew he was hiding something. And we broke for lunch.
Yeah.
I was like crushed. We were angry. We were frustrated. And it's like, we're walking lunch. It's like, okay, we got to regroup. We have to do something.
And not angry at Joe. Angry at the situation.
Yes.
Yeah. And
kind of, look, sorry, Dave. Sorry, Dan.
Randy.
Randy. Dan. That's where Dan came from. I don't know. I was angry at the attorneys because we weren't sold on the strategy going into it. It's kind of like we sold them on the jacket. They sold us on the strategy. I got to say, we won.
The jacket was
the right call.
In hindsight, I don't know that either of us won, but.
The jacket was the right call.
Okay.
Joe looked good. Could you imagine if he wasn't wearing the jacket and he was answering that way?
Oh.
So.
Anyway, at lunch, we just said, hey, take the shackles off. Just let him go. Joe, we didn't do anything wrong. If you didn't do anything wrong, just talk. You have
nothing to hide.
We've got nothing to hide. Just tell the story. Tell the truth. Answer the questions. We can rehab if we need to. Just, Joe,
let it rip. Joe.
Let it rip. I think that was actually the words we said when he was walking up. Let it rip. And so we did. We got back after lunch and it's still Joe on the stand. Dan's still asking questions, but it was a completely different afternoon than it was morning. It was just, Joe was different, and it totally threw Dan off. Joe's starting to come across as likable.
Yeah. I mean, right, Dan. Joe was a whipping boy in the first half of the before lunch, and Dan comes back. He's thinking he's going to continue the assault, and all of a sudden, he got zinged. Yes. He's like, what was that?
Yes.
And then Joe starts feeling it, and Joe starts getting more confident with his answers, and he starts answering with information and truthful and explaining and doing things. And it was a 180.
I mean, we almost started cheering from the table over there. It was again, sporting events. If you've ever watched a game, the first half goes completely momentum wrong and you're like, and something changes you at halftime.
One little thing.
Get a break. And all of a sudden we were on offense. Joe connected with the jury. I mean, he was friendly. Everybody, the story's going our way. Dan's stumbling again. And we come back. I mean, I think we nicknamed him Joe Montana, the comeback kid, right? I mean, it was awesome. So we were thrilled. And I mean, Joe's done. We're doing high fives. It was a great afternoon. And so much so that Dan actually stops questioning and like is trying to regroup a little bit. Right.
Yeah. So I'm sure he had planned on going the whole afternoon and it was like an hour and a half into the afternoon session. He was done.
They're done. So
then
he comes up and so again, we've talked about this, the way it works is if the plaintiffs JSA in this case, calls a witness. They call Joe. They get to ask questions. Then we get a chance to cross-examine the witness. And then they get a chance to recross or to rehab the witness. So in this case, we have our afternoon break. They've, you know, rested on Joe, and it's our turn to cross-examine. And so we're looking at it like, what are the things where we have to go back and correct or rehabilitate or fix? And in a
what we thought
like a moment of sheer genius, one of our attorneys, Randy, says, "Hey, what if we don't even cross-examine Joe?" And we're like, "What?" But there were some things in the morning that we need to fix. And the thought was, the afternoon went so well.
Leave it at that.
The vision in the jury's minds is what they just saw. And if we cross-examine,
they get the chance,
they get
to,
a
come
chance
back
to
up,
ask some more questions.
Right? They get to rehabilitate.
Right.
Witness.
But if we don't, they are, you know, in essence, that Randy is saying, Joe rehabilitated himself. We don't need to do the rehabilitation. Joe already did. So there's nothing else we're going to cover. Just let it go. They don't get to ask any more questions. And Joe's done on the stand. So there's strategy in trials.
I was going to say, the trial, especially, you see it going into, but now that we're removed from it, we look back, there is a lot of strategy. There are a lot of decisions. There's a, you know, you call it the cat and mouse game, and you're trying to judge how, reading the jury and see how they're reacting, look at the other side, see how they're reacting, look at the witness or who's up there, what, you know, what are the pros, what are the cons, and we made that call that at the time felt like a great call.
And so this is an afternoon break. It's like 2:30, 3 o'clock, and we decide to pass. So we knew if we did ask questions, we would ask questions, and then they would come essentially back up, get
and it's the whole
the
day.
Weekend, or no, there was a day off. The next day was a day off. So we get a day off, and they would have time to come up with more questions. So we said, nope, we're not going to ask any questions of Joe. And they were shocked, right? The other side.
Oh, yeah.
We stumped them. Like, it's like when you call a flea flicker and it works, and the other side's like caught standing there, like, what's going on? That what we were feeling pretty good at the moment.
Yeah.
Like, this is great. So they decide to call their next witness, and they choose you.
They choose Dale.
They think they see, look, an opportunity.
I gotta tell you, the palms get a little sweaty as soon as you hear that. Like, you know it's coming. I knew it was coming at some point. And then you hear you're the witness. There's a pit in the stomach, because again, it's like there's so much on the line, and you're, you know, what are they going to say? It's kind of like the depositions, except for a lot more intense, because you know they're trying to trick you. You know they're trying to catch you, make you say something. You're in front of a jury.
Yeah, there's an audience.
You can't take anything back. You can't wait a second. Let me change that.
You're literally up on a stand, the entire room staring at you with a guy asking you questions, trying to throw you off.
PTSD.
Yeah.
So here I go. Walk up onto the stand.
So we will pick that up, you actually on the stand, next episode, and talk about what happened there. But I kind of want to jump to what happened that night. There's something else that happened. So the next day was a dark day, right? The next day was a day off. And that was the day we had scheduled Eli's funeral. So after trial that night, we're high-fiving, right? We're feeling good about the way the day had shifted and gone our way.
It started bad. The only period in our time so far was bad, and it reversed,
right,
and finished strong. So we felt good about it.
So we, that night, race to the airport. We get on a plane and we head to
Albuquerque.
And the next day, Wednesday, we spend at a funeral for Eli. And it was just such an odd switch, right? We had this feeling of, you know, we were defending our business and just trying to go through this, you know, very intense emotional experience there. And then we're at a funeral, and this is for the very first person that I ever hired.
It's kind of the start of it
for
all,
everyone,
right? I mean,
or even before for everyone.
We'd been out there for 6 months before we hired Eli, but that was it. And we'd brought Nate out.
Yeah.
But Eli, I would say, was really the first true hire. And he was a close friend. And then he became an enemy,
yeah,
in a way. Right?
Adversary, at least. So
adversary, right? And we've talked about this before, but
I know not everybody's heard everything.
Quick recap, yeah. Right? he was our salesman. And right at the time when AstroTurf filed bankruptcy and we were out and we're trying to figure out what we're going to do moving forward, he and Richard, another guy, was our like project lead or like operations manager. They'd worked two consecutive home shows. They did a home show in El Paso, they did a home show in Albuquerque, and those were that drives your year out
for,
there.
For us out there, that would represent
50% of the business we do that year from those two home shows. And they took all those leads, they did them without us, and they left. They moved what, a mile and a half down the street?
Yep.
Started another turf company, took all our leads, probably at least $250,000 worth of revenue, maybe more, maybe up to $400,000 of revenue. I'm sure they would have gotten, or we would have generated out of those leads. They became our competition. But we never truly turned our back on Eli, and he came back.
Yeah. I mean, that business lasted a year or two and then kind of imploded. And Eli got sick, right? He ended up being diagnosed with cancer.
And he didn't have money. And
didn't have family.
He came to us, and we were, for a period of time, just writing him checks to help him cover medical bills and living expenses. And then it wasn't good for him because I know he felt bad about it. He was always talking about how he was going to pay us back. And so we said, Eli, why don't you do some work for us? Why don't we just hire you? So we actually hired him to come in and just make phone calls and just leads would come in. Eli, can you just call him and talk to him? And so he did that. But
yeah, and as we moved back to Ohio, Joe kind of stepped in and became like a surrogate brother or friend to Eli and really took care of Eli, had him over for dinner, you know, would check in on him, was, you know, his point person in the office when he would come in. And so, you know, really that, you know, we talked about the tale of two Joes. Joe on the stand in the morning looked evasive and like a grumpy guy, and in the afternoon was friendly. The grandpa everybody loved and rehabilitated. And then this is kind of the third picture of Joe, which was the guy who stepped in and really became a friend and a confidant of Eli and was really, I mean, honestly, was the hands and feet of Christ there at the end. And
And Brian, we went through a whole period. And again, we may have talked about this on some previous episodes, but Eli was a cantankerous old man. Mm-hmm. He was not a Christian man, but he was always interested in us and in our story. And our kids actually kind of picked up the ball of when we were back in Ohio and Eli was in New Mexico, of like reaching out to him, talking to him, witnessing to him, writing him letters, sending him books, calling and talking to him. And over the course of like, from 2007 when we moved through 2009, Eli actually called us and told us he gave his life to Christ. And right. He also had a hospice nurse as he was dying that came in and talked with him. And it was just, it was such a story of up and down, a story of redemption, a story of so many different things that here we are now in the middle of this trial. Right. We said Eli died right at the beginning of the trial. And now we are in the middle of the trial going out for his funeral. I didn't expect it. It was very emotional for me.
Yeah, it was. And his funeral was a very small affair. Yeah. Were eight
people there?
Yeah. I mean, there was you and me, Joe and Richard.
Yep.
All the four of us.
I think the nurse was there.
Right. We all said something, but really, there were only about another three or four people there.
I think the hospice
there.
Nurse was there and then maybe two other people that I don't think I knew.
Yeah. And it was an odd experience and it was difficult. It was emotional. There's never a good time for death or funerals. But it just felt so odd to be in this battle in California and then have to leave, take a flight to Albuquerque, go through this funeral for the first person we ever hired and somebody that became a friend and then an enemy and then a friend again. And then the next day we're back at trial, right? It's just right in the middle of it. So that night, we jump back on a plane.
Back to LA.
Head to LA. And we will pick up next week with Dale on the stand.
Still feeling a little nervous. We'll see you guys. Have a great week.
This is the Fredco Army reminding you that faith looks up, hope looks ahead, and love looks all around to see whom it can help. Good day.